Where the Legends Play, Willie 1550 and 98.7. Hello there, I'm Kenny Graves, and proud to have on the phone with me, well, this may take a minute to do his intro because he's got a lot to talk about. As a recording artist, he has charted 16 singles on the country chart, including 9 top 10s and 2 number 1 singles, and he's had 2 number 1 hits on Christian radio. And as a songwriter, he is one of the greatest of all time. He's written or co-written some mega hits for names like Randy Travis, Keith Whitley, The Judds, George Jones, Tanya Tucker, Kenny Chesney, Blake Shelton, and Alan Jackson. Oh, I gotta take a breath here. He's had 2 Grammy Awards, 2 CMA Song of the Year Awards, and was named BMI Songwriter of the Year an unprecedented 5 straight years. And he's an interesting gentleman. His name is Paul Overstreet. Mr. Paul, how are you, sir?
I'm good, Willie. How you doing, brother?
I'm hanging in there, man. Hanging in there. I've been looking forward to this. Like I said, I've been a fan of your work all of my life. You've written some of the biggest songs in country's history. So, pleasure to have you on.
Yeah, it's an honor to be with you. Thanks for asking me on your show.
Absolutely. Let's just get right into it then. At what age did you begin to write songs seriously?
I was trying when I was a kid. I saw that Hank Williams movie about Your Cheating Heart, and man, I just thought that was the coolest thing ever. And I wanted to do that, so I started trying to write songs back in those days, and I'd try to write like Marty Robbins and all the Gunfighter albums he had and Hank Sr. And it was a little frustrating because I just knew they weren't as good as those guys.
Well, I think you worked on that, though, over the years. But I love the story. Like, right out of high school, you took off to Nashville. You didn't even own a suitcase. Is that correct? You had basically a laundry basket?
Yeah, when I came to Nashville, I did. But when I graduated high school, my mom gave me a suitcase. I don't know what she meant by that.
But it sounds better.
I went to Texas for a little while, and I went out there and lived with my brother. We worked at this Young Brothers Construction Company, and that's where I saw Johnny Rodriguez and Tanya Tucker play. And so after their show, I stayed later and talked to Tanya just a little bit, and kind of inspired me to go to Nashville. And so I went to the company, told them I was going to be leaving, going to Nashville. They told me that they'd keep my job open for me.
That was nice of them.
It was. But I thought it was.
But now, well, with what I read then, is it true you did sleep in your 68 Fairlane?
Yeah, slept in that car a couple nights on the side of the road because I told my mom, I said, man, I'm in a pretty tough place here, and she could send me some money, but she mailed it. He mailed me a check, so I had to wait 2 or 3 days for it to get there. And I slept on the side of the road in my car, and the police would come by every couple of hours, shine their light in there to see what was going on. And I guess they don't like you just pulling over on the side of the road and going to sleep.
Yeah, but when you're tired, right?
Yeah. Tired and hungry.
Well, things change for you. So we'll say here, as a solo vocalist, your first big success came after co-writing I Won't Take Less Than Your Love with another great songwriter, Don Schlitz. And it was a number one hit. You had recorded that with Paul Davis and Tanya Tucker. So how did your life and your career change at that point?
Actually, you know, things had changed a little earlier. I mean, same on me with George Jones helped a lot. It kind of got me out of it with Oak Ridge Boys singing background. I was writing songs for their publishing company at the time. And they're the ones that kind of instigated getting that song cut by George. And they went to his producer and said they felt like they had a song that he could do. And if they recorded it, they would sing the backgrounds on it. So that was a big boost for me. So I always have to give them thanks for that. And that song kind of got me out of the hole a little bit and got me a place to live, but you know, this industry's so crazy. It was about 4 more years before I had another hit.
Yes, sir. And around that time too, you joined up with 2 other very talented guys and formed SKO. So tell me about that experience and what it was like working with them.
Well, Tom's from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and he's a really great craftsman as a lyricist and writer. You know, he did stuff for Lacey Dalton, Old Yellow Car, and things like that. And Fred had been in L.A. and had a little bit of the L.A. musical influence, but he grew up in Mississippi, same as I did. So we started playing live shows and just kind of setting in with each other. You know, we'd be like in a round or something like that, and we were all writing for the same publishing company at the time. And we just talked about, why don't we just learn each other's songs, and then when we perform them, we can help the other one play the songs and sing backgrounds to them. And so that's what we started doing, and doing live, and people started coming up saying, man, you guys are a group. And we were like, really? We're three writers just trying to help each other with their songs. And then MTM Records wanted to sign us, so we wound up doing an album. But we all signed contracts for solo projects as well. And so I guess that was after our first album. I was going through kind of a spiritual renaissance in my life, and I had some ideas that I wanted to pursue, and they were definitely into doing the group thing at Fable. And so we just kind of had different directions there. And after the first album, I kind of wanted to just step out of the band and let them take it, and they got another guy to take my place, and so I went on to do the stuff.
And that was a good move on your part, because things really got cooking quick. You released your first solo album for RCA Records called So In Love. Most people remember that song. And it produced a top 10, four top five hits as well. And then suddenly you're kind of a household name. So what was that like?
I don't know if you really think about it like that. I was always trying to figure out how I can make it better, you know, do something a little better. Instead of just enjoying it, you know, I don't know. I think when you're going through it, you don't really take time to even know what's going on.
Well, and I noticed, though, at least with your album, like the songs you had written, it seemed to help, for me anyway, balance out country music. Country music does contain a lot of pain and heartache and some things that aren't so great, but you can also add some positivity and some hopefulness into music, and that's what seemed like you did. You infused some hope into country music and helped balance things out. At least, I've been a lifelong fan. For me, it did. I thought that was a great thing.
Yeah, well, you know, that was a conscious decision that I had to make in my life. Basically, it was more for my life than it was for the music industry. The music industry kind of liked those real hard, hurting, heartbroken songs. Every time I'd pick up my guitar, I was saying those things, you know, kind of, even though I wasn't feeling it, I was saying it. And it, after a while, I started to realize, you know, I need to be saying positive things about my life and about my, you know, about my world around me. And so through, you know, the spiritual renaissance I was going through, it just kind of helped me to develop some songs that were positive and said things about things that I thought were beautiful. And that changed my whole world, actually.
Well, it comes through in the music, and the success you've had is an attestment to that. People respond to it. And you had some great success there as a solo artist up through the middle of the 90s. But later on, you also recorded a gospel album and a Christmas album. So what is the current or the next project for you?
Okay, well, I did it. My website is pauloverstreet.com. And on my website, we have a lot of new projects, new albums and things like that, that I'm always recording and releasing new stuff on the internet and on our website. And you can follow that. Country music is like, when you get older, I mean, we learned that modern radio kind of turns to the younger artist. And so they don't really give it that much attention if you... You know, an older artist puts out a record. But I'm still as much of a writer and an artist as I ever was. So I just keep doing it. And a lot of my songs are not 2.5 minutes or 3 minutes. Some of them are 4 minutes. And this, because because it needs that much time for the story.
That's right.
And I hate to kill the story in a song, you know, and just do 3 minutes. And because if a story needs to develop, and, well, I'll tell you a funny story. When my first singles was Beautiful Baby, when I was on RCA the first time.
That 82, right?
Yeah, something like that. And I was like, my first song was Beautiful Baby, which it didn't have, it had the chorus at the end of the song, or a release. I call it a release, but it was verse, and then at the end it kind of released into this sing-along chorus. But the record company, after we mixed the track, sent it to them. They sent it back to us mastered with all sped up, sound like a chipmunk. And we went, well, that's not going to work. Why did you do that? And they said, well, it doesn't get to the chorus fast enough.
Wow.
So it's just like they took a piece of art and just ruined it trying to get to the chorus fast enough. So, you know, and there's a phrase here in Nashville that writers use called get to the chorus, don't chorus.
Well, you have to have an arc to tell the story, right? You have to have a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah. And but a lot of songs don't have stories right now. But I like story songs. I always did. I think as a kid, I always loved Luke the Drifter, Hank Williamson, Alter Ego.
Oh, yeah, Luke the Drifter.
Those songs were so good. Picture from Life's Other Side. And, gosh, there's so many.
And the Marty Robbins, like you said, you know, Big Iron and Streets of Laredo. And all these songs had great stories.
Mm-hmm. Big Iron on his hip. Those kind of songs. Yeah, but we're talking about stuff people probably don't even remember.
We play it on this station, so they remember if they're listening.
Okay, good.
But I have a couple of questions now. I've been writing since I was in the fifth grade, so I have a couple of writing questions for you. So what is the writing process like for you? I mean, do you wait for inspiration to hit, or do you actually schedule a block of time and your brain just goes to work?
Well, I do it both ways. I schedule writing appointments with other writers, and that causes me to think ahead and start thinking about what we're going to work on or what would be a good idea, so I'm always looking for them. I've noticed that when I quit writing, I quit looking for ideas. I do it all the time. I do it as an exercise. Some songs are not that great. I have the craft developed to the point where they're not bad songs. I mean, they're just not great songs, but I do it as an exercise, and then when that incredible idea happens, then you're ready to write it. You're in shape, you're prepared, and you're used to writing, so it's an easy task.
That's good to know. So, okay, one other one here. When you're writing, do you begin with a melody or a title or something else?
Well, I personally kind of let the idea dictate what it is. Sometimes, you know, people will be saying, hey, everybody's looking for up-tempo songs. Let's write an up-tempo song. So you know you're going to write an up-tempo song. But the phrasing of it usually comes with the idea, or the phrase will give you a tempo. And if you listen to what the words are, you know, whatever the line would be, is like, you know, I can't stop loving you. You take that and you just put that in the best vehicle you can find for it. And it may be, that sentiment needs a, I can't stop loving. It needs that phrasing, because that was just, but, you know, songs change with people's attention span too, you know. People don't want to, if they don't want a slow song, they're not ready to listen to a slow song. Then, you know, you're kind of wasting your time trying to write them for artists that are on the radio that don't support them.
Wow, that is fascinating stuff. Inside the mind of one of the greatest songwriters ever. So one last question. I got to make it a tough one now, Paul. Of the songs you've written that have been released to radio where people have heard them, which one are you most proud of and why?
Interesting. I'll tell you, honestly, the song When You Say Nothing at All, and Forever and Ever, Amen, those two were always neck and neck.
I can see that.
What they said. I mean, I had just gotten married when we wrote Forever and Ever, Amen, so anytime I sat down to write a real committed love song, you know, like confessing everything, being perfect, I felt a little bit guilty because, you know, I just been such a rough guy. My life had been kind of rough, so I know the first lines of that song. You may think that I'm talking foolish. You know, I'm forever and ever, amen.
Yes, sir.
And because it sounds like it. I mean, the people who knew me, they'd go, he's just saying stuff he didn't mean. But at that time, I mean, Don Slitz, now he had the original idea. At the end of the Lord's Prayer, you say forever and ever, amen. And he was learning to say the Lord's Prayer, Don's son, and he said, after everything he would say, Mommy, I love you forever and ever, amen.
Aww.
And then Don said, man, you know, I think that could be a really good idea. And so he called me. I'd been playing golf that day, and I'd played like 36 holes, so I was a little bit
spent,
tired. And he said, man, we got to write this idea. And I said, well, you want to do it tomorrow? And he goes, no, we got to do it now. And so I'm so thankful he did that, though, you know, because I said, okay, well, let me get home, grab a bite to eat, and then come on over and we'll write it. And so we sat on my front porch and had a little candle lit and sat out there and wrote it on a legal pad, you know, the lyrics, and wrote the song, finished it up there.
And the rest is history, shall we say.
Yeah. So that was a great song. And When You Say Nothing at All to Me is one of those songs that I never really knew how powerful that song was. It just always impacted people. I mean, I could be playing in a room that wasn't really paying attention that much, pretty loud, people talking. And I could play that song, and the room would get quiet. It still does.
Yeah, a pin drop.
Yeah, it was amazing. So there's something in that song. There's a little element to songs that we, in our conscious mind, don't even realize, but some of them are just heaven sent, I think.
Ordained.
And they do a work on their own, and I think that song has that quality to it.
Yeah, I've heard that from other writers. I think T. Graham Brown said that about Wine Into Water. He said it when he sings it, it goes dead quiet, and he believes it was ordained by God. So,
oh, that's good.
I do believe in that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And you picked two.
I like that song. I thought T. Graham and them did a great job on that song.
Oh, agreed.
Yeah, I think it was heartfelt, and I think they meant every word of it.
Yeah, but we're speaking with the legend himself, Mr. Paul Overstreet. He has written so. How many top tens have you written for other people? I mean, it's like 37.
Don't give me the line. I don't know.
it's closing in on 40, I know. So.
Yeah, I don't count them. I just try to write them.
Well, you do it well. And you can catch him at pauloverstreet.com. I know you got a writing session coming up, so I won't hold you. But Mr. Paul Overstreet, maybe I can get you back on one sometime. Well, you got something coming up?
You just call me anytime. You got my number.
I do. I appreciate it. And for Mr. Paul Overstreet, I'm Kenny Graves here on Willie 1550 and 98.7.